The price of gas in San Diego is now in the neighborhood of $3.90 a gallon for self-serve regular. In a way, that high price is good news because it means more and more people are buying smaller cars. But while we're pleased that some cars can get more than 40 miles to the gallon, couldn't we do better than that? A new independent film called Gas Hole suggests that we can. In fact, it makes the case that a car getting more than 100 miles to the gallon could have been developed and sold decades ago. The movie is being shown this weekend at San Diego's Eco Center, and we're going to take this opportunity to talk about the high price of gas and alternative fuels. If you want to talk about that, give us a call at 1-888-895-5727. That's 888-895-KPBS. Let me first introduce the two guys who produced the film Gas Hole. Jeremy Wagner and Scott Roberts are directors, our co-directors, producers of the new documentary. And Jeremy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
And Scott, thanks to you.
Hey, thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Well, why did you decide to make a film about gas consumption? Scott, do you want to start?
Yeah, actually, you know, Jeremy and I both come from the narrative world of making movies. And so this was our first documentary. And I had read a letter to the editor in Northern California by a gentleman who remembered in the late 40s that they used to race their cars at an airfield, and they met a gentleman who drove up in a 1946 Buick Roadmaster, popped the hood, and said, "Hey, you know, check it out. I invented this water-injected carburetor, and I get 100 miles per gallon. Shell Oil bought my patent, made me a millionaire, told me I couldn't build anymore, but I could keep the ones on my car." And so this gentleman wrote a letter to the editor saying, you know, what happened to this? And you know, why are we paying? And at the time, gas was $2.20 a gallon, and people were outraged. And so we said, you know what, why don't we take a look at this? And we knew there was something there. We didn't know if it was a feature film, if it was a documentary. And that's where it all started.
Jeremy, anything you want to add to that?
Absolutely. After Scott came to me with that idea, then we went and interviewed the gentleman, and we started to research this idea, this patent, and we found a lot of very interesting things. One of the things that happened, though, is we started to talk to people as we started to hear more of these stories. And in our film, we look at three different types of stories like this, the ones that we could substantiate the most. And then from there, the film really takes a broad look from that point, where we went to Congress to see what was happening in Congress, why we haven't improved our fuel standard, our miles per gallon standards in 25 years. What are the roadblocks in Congress?
Well, one thing that I did kind of like in your movie was the very beginning, where you started with Richard Nixon and went to Gerald Ford, then Jimmy Carter, and they were all saying the same thing. We are going to end our dependence on foreign oil, and we're going to make ourselves energy independent. And presidents have said this over and over and over again. And, well, I guess the fact that that's so dramatic, Scott, is why you started the movie with that.
Yeah, it was, you know, you're always trying to find a different way to start the movie and have a hook and get people locked in. And, you know, we just looked at transcripts of past State of the Union addresses, and we were so shocked that, like you said, everyone was saying exactly the same thing decade after decade. And when you hear the president say those things, and then you find out the things that Jeremy and I found out about past technologies, and you know, if these technologies would have been implemented, we wouldn't even be having this discussion today.
Listeners, give us a call at 1-888-895-5727. We're especially interested in people who drive cars that use either electricity or alternative fuels. Tell us your story. Tell us why you do it, and tell us how much it costs. 888-895-KPBS is the call-in number. Scott, let me get back to the story of the guy that you interviewed who knew this guy who invented a new system of carburation. And basically what it did is it allowed the car to, I'm not an auto technician, so I don't understand this stuff all that well, but it allowed the car to drive on fumes more?
There are actually a number of different stories.
Jeremy is telling the story.
The the first story that we look at with this water-injected carburetor, neither Scott or I are you know, car mechanics as well, so we took it to a mechanical engineer who read over the patent just to see if it was a feasible idea.
So you've got a copy of the patent?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
So this particular patent, and we believe it could be the patent that that this gentleman saw. The way that that technology would work is it with the water injection, it allows the combustion to happen at a lower temperature. Part of when you run an engine, most of the energy is lost in heat. So if you are combusting at a lower temperature, you lose less heat, so you improve your fuel efficiency. There's another idea, idea that's different from that, in which that we examine, and that other water, the high, I'm sorry, the vapor engine would work in a way which you're only putting vapor into the cylinder, so there's less waste. So again, it improves that fuel efficiency.
Well, the water-injected carburetor, tell us again what happened to it. It was bought by Shell? The patent was bought by Shell?
According to our witness, it was bought by Shell. We looked into, you know, we thought, well, you know, at that time in the 40s, how would someone living in Northern California get in touch with any Shell research people? And then we discovered that there was a Shell research lab less than 10 miles from where this all took place.
In Modesto.
And so we actually put the pieces of the puzzle together with all three of our stories. And really what set the tone for us, or what really solidified and substantiated for us, is, and I don't want to give away too much because we want people to see the movie, but when we found a retired Shell research scientist in London, and the things that he told us just so flippantly was shocking. Absolutely shocking. I think that's a lot of people that come out of the movie, you know, or just can't believe that in the 60s we were getting 367 miles per gallon on a Fiat.
This is interesting because when we talk about cars that get really good gas mileage or are environmentally friendly today, we don't usually talk about conventional gas systems like this, but you're saying this was just an innovative carburation system that achieved this tremendous gas mileage.
Well, one of the things that we didn't realize as well when we were looking at the film, and I think most people haven't realized, is we actually get overall less fuel economy today than we did in the 80s. Now, I would have assumed that we're in the 21st century now, that our fuel economy should be much greater. I mean, the size of my television is now the size of my wall. And the other technological advances that we've made are fantastic. But for some reason, how can fuel economy continue to decline?
Well, Scott, this is a conspiracy theory, right?
It's
Shell conspired to buy this patent and suppress this technology so it could sell more gas.
Well, it's a strong statement to make, and we try and look at it as, you know, in the late 40s, fuel economy was not an issue. It really wasn't. No one was really concerned about it. Gas was like 5 cents a gallon. And so by them, you know, taking technology and for whatever reason not bringing it to market, actually was a good business decision. I don't see anything malicious about it because, you know, economics and capitalism. But when you get closer to the 70s and the Mideast oil crisis and you realize what they were doing in terms of compiling all their data going back to the late 30s and the kind of fuel economy they were achieving over that time, and they were asked to put it into a book called Fuel Economy of the Gasoline Engine, and then stopped the program, or told the scientists to stop what they were doing right at the height of the Mideast oil crisis, it makes you wonder about their motives.
Have you guys seen the movie Who Killed the Electric Car?
Mm-hmm.
Similar story is told in that about, in this case, the automobile industry trying to suppress technology. So that's kind of interesting. By the way, Jeremy, did you talk to Shell Oil Company?
We tried to talk to all of the oil companies, you know, and again, for Scott and I, the thing you may not realize is we're both registered Republicans, you know, and we're capitalists. We came at this just saying this is a problem and let's address the problem. So we did contact the oil industry and say, we want to know what you're doing. What are you doing? How much money are you spending now? What are the next 5 years going to be? What are the next 10 years going to be? And where, what direction are you taking it in? But they obviously weren't very interested in talking to us.
I'm talking with Jeremy Wagner and Scott Roberts. They are co-directors, co-producers of the new documentary Gas Hole, which is going to be shown this weekend at the San Diego Eco Center. And give us a call if you want it. 1-888-895-KPBS. Let's go to Don in Carlsbad. Don, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Speaking of who killed the electric car, I've been attending the American Solar Energy Conference in San Diego the past few days.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple evenings ago, Chris Payne, the producer and director of Who Killed the Electric Car, was one of the guests. And he brought up what was shown in the movie as far as Texaco buying the patent for, I think it was, nickel metal hydride battery technology, and basically putting on the shelf and not moving it forward. And as a result, the electric vehicle market and the plug-in hybrid vehicle market is moving very slowly in this country, but then that's opening up the market for foreign competition. It's my understanding Norway is going to be exporting the first Norwegian car into the United States, called the Think, an all-electric vehicle. So I think it's just an example of very short-sighted corporate quarter-to-quarter profit taking rather than any kind of long-term planning. And as a result, we're giving the emerging vehicle market to the foreign competition, just like we did the compact market to the foreign competition in the early 70s.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Let's take another call. We've got Ian on the line from Oceanside. Ian, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you both for what you do. And I grew up in Berkeley, California, and there was a family up the block that had a car back in the late 80s that ran on electricity. And so I know that technology was available, and part of the changes in Berkeley is that they now offer plug-in sites for electric cars in garages downtown, and I know it wasn't available before, so it would be a limited-use vehicle. And part of the reason I think that the electric vehicles haven't caught on is because the infrastructures of most cities don't support that technology. And besides that, people are pretty addicted to their gas vehicles.
Thanks very much. Scott, Jeremy, want to say anything to either of those callers?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that we've come to with this film, we've talked a little bit about these patents and things, but our film really looks at the whole topic, and we look at a number of different alternative solutions to the problem. For us, it's not a question of is electric vehicles the solution? Is biodiesel the solution? For us, I think what the summary is that the problem is not a technological problem. We've heard over and over again so many different ideas that can solve the problem. The reason why we're still addicted to oil, to foreign sources of oil, that problem is an economic problem, a social problem, and a political problem, but it's certainly not a technological problem.
With that, let me introduce another guest who's going to join us here in studio. Mike Lewis is general manager of Pearson Fuels. Pearson Fuels opened in 2003 as the world's first alternative fuels station. And Mike is also chairman of the San Diego Eco Center, which is going to show the film Gas Hole. Mike, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me again, Tom.
And once again, listeners, you can call us at 1-888-895-KPBS. Mike, what do you want to say about the film Gas Hole? And
well,
Gas Hole and the message that it's trying to send to people.
Well, I haven't seen the film yet. I've only seen the trailer, and the first time it's going to be shown is tomorrow night at our Eco Center at 7 o'clock. And it's interesting to me because I have the feeling, well, I know, that the American public for years, decades, has been discussing this subject. I have a quote on my wall from 1922 that says, the increase in the price of gasoline calls into question the whole fuel issue. From 1922. You know, I've been talking about this when we broke $2 a gallon, and I've been talking about it since we broke $3 a gallon, and I'm talking about it when we broke $4 a gallon, and all that since we've been opened in 2003.
Since you sell alternative fuels, why don't you tell us, how has the high cost of gasoline affected your business? Is it as a result of that, are you drawing more customers?
We have a couple of our fuels, yes, absolutely. Natural gas, we're selling more natural gas. The vehicles have to be made specifically to run on natural gas. And we are selling, I would say, easily 10 times the ethanol that we have sold in months a few years ago. There are a lot more ethanol vehicles on the road right now. And we've had a significant increase in the ethanol purchases. And within a mile radius of our station, three gas stations have gone out of business in the last 6 months to a year. And undoubtedly, if it weren't for our alternative fuels, we would have been one of those.
Let's go to John in Carlsbad, wants to join the conversation. John, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
All right.
I haven't seen the documentary or the trailer, but just a few things that have been mentioned don't quite add up. In terms of the Shell buying the patent in 1940 from this individual with the very high efficiency car, I mean, wouldn't the patent expire in 20 years, which would mean that anybody could then develop that technology? It just seems that investors, venture capitalists, would have flocked to that kind of technology, and even today or 10, 20 years ago. And another thing, when they mentioned the having combustion at a lower temperature, in general, the higher the temperature difference, the higher the efficiency of the system. In mechanical engineering, there's something called the Carnot efficiency. And the higher the temperature difference, the higher this fundamental limit of efficiency you can obtain. So anyhow, maybe you could just comment on that and just a few points I wanted to make.
Well, thanks very much, John. I'm afraid you know too much, at least too much for me. I certainly can't respond to that second thing you said, but I do want our filmmakers to respond to your first point. And I suppose John is right. Even if there was a patent on this technology back in 1940, that would have expired by now. So if this system is out there, someone could develop it and use it.
Absolutely. Well, this is what we've come to. We've done a lot of these radio shows, and we have been, this is going to be our seventh city that we've taken the film to. In every one of these cities, we talk to people who have technologies now, have ideas now that they're running on their cars that have dramatically improved their fuel efficiency. Is it 100 miles? I don't know. But they're absolutely getting much better gas mileage by doing conversions, whether it's a water-injected carburetor or a different idea. The problem that we've heard from these people is that it takes so long to get through the patent process, and then even if you get through the patent process, there's so much red tape, especially in California, to be able to bring that technology to market, and the cost involved of getting through that process is just so much beyond these people's means, and they are taking them to venture capitalists, but it's a big uphill climb. And one of the things that we can show you or that we look at as a question of what they're up against is in the LA Times 2 weeks ago, Chevy had a separate section advertisement. And on the front page, they advertised the Chevy Tahoe Hybrid as the 2008 Green Car of the Year. Now, the Chevy Tahoe Hybrid is getting 22 miles per gallon. If you turn that
green car of the year, and it's getting 22 miles a gallon.
And then you turn the page, and on inside, they're advertising the regular Tahoe, the regular combustion Tahoe, and that gets 20 miles to the gallon. So I would think, from a capitalist standpoint, that fuel efficiency should really be what people are wanting. But if you're spending millions and millions of dollars to advertise 2 miles per gallon, there's something that's not adding up.
We have to take a break, but when we return, we'll be back with Jeremy Wagner and Scott Roberts, who are co-producers of the new documentary called Gas Hole, and Mike Lewis with Pearson Fuels. If you want to join our conversation, if you drive a car that uses alternative energy, tell us about it. The number is 1-888-895-KPBS. Right now, we're talking about alternative fuels, and I'm speaking with the producers of a new documentary film called Gas Hole. Those producers, directors are Jeremy Wagner and Scott Roberts. They join me in studio. Mike Lewis also joins me in studio. He is general manager of Pearson Fuels and chairman of the San Diego Eco Center, which is where the film Gas Hole is going to be shown this weekend. If you want more information about that, go to our website, kpbs.org. We'll tell you where the Eco Center is and all that. It's on El Cajon Boulevard. I guess I can say that much on the air. 888-895-KPBS. And before we get back to our callers, Mike, a question for you. You were talking about the fact that Pearson Fuels is in a neighborhood where apparently the high cost of gasoline has caused a couple of service stations in your neighborhood to go out of business. Now, why would the high cost of gas cause a gas station to go out of business?
Well, all gas stations, whether they are branded with a particular oil company or they are independent like us, are buying their fuel from the oil companies. I mean, I'm competing with ARCO five blocks away. ARCO owns the oil under the ocean. Okay, I own the gasoline in the tank. So when I'm competing with them directly, they're selling the fuel retail many times for less than I can buy it wholesale. So when you're in that environment, you know, that's why gas stations are crazy to sell you ices and hot dogs and things like that, because if you're selling the gas at a break even, the amount of money that's required to be invested in the environmental regulations to sell gasoline are so massive that you better be selling a lot of hot dogs and things like that. And frankly, a lot of the gas stations haven't been able to sell as much enough.
So it sounds like if you want to blame somebody for the high price of gas, don't blame the retailer, because he's not making much money.
I think the industry average is 13 cents a gallon the last couple of years. And when you consider what's that percentage? I mean, if gas is $4 a gallon.
13 cents a gallon profit?
Yes. Okay. For the gas station, the average gas station. For the last month in April, we made 6 cents a gallon. So it's just, you know, barely pays for the electricity, let alone the employees and the rent and the equipment and things like that. So the retailers are being narrowed down. And if you look at the numbers for the last few years, they are narrowing down. And that's where there are almost no independently owned gas stations. Try to think of one.
But the wholesalers of gas, they're doing pretty good.
Well, the refiners have historically made a lot of money. That's narrowing. And the people that produce the oil, I've heard, and I'm not an expert on this, but once you have the well, it takes less than a dollar a barrel to bring a barrel of oil out of the ground.
Well, oil companies are making huge profits.
Absolutely. And the refiners
The last news story I read said that.
Absolutely, but the gas station owners are not the oil companies. The gas station owners, even your guy who has Chevron or Shell or whatever on the sign, has to buy his fuel from them and has to buy it at the price that they say. So, it's so competitive. I can tell you, for 3 cents a gallon versus that Sarco near us, for 3 cents a gallon, my volume will go up and down 1,000 gallons a day. So the public is so concerned with the price of gas that the presidential candidates can talk about an 18 cents gas tax reduction, which will get them probably millions of votes. And the wholesale price of gas from Friday to Monday went up 24 cents in San Diego.
By the way, Scott, what do you think of that proposal from John McCain and Hillary Clinton that we get rid of that federal gas tax for a while?
To me, it makes no sense personally, just because, you know, you mentioned that the oil companies were making record-breaking profits, but what we're forgetting too is that they're also enjoying record-breaking tax breaks and have been for a long time. So you're going to ask the American public to reduce the pool of money that's going for taxes, yet the oil companies are not going to feel anything from that. They're still going to make their profits and they still get their tax breaks. So, you know, I agree with Mike. I just think it's a way to get votes, but I really don't think it's the answer.
By the way, Jeremy, are you still a registered Republican?
Yeah, I am still a registered Republican. For us, what we found going to Washington is that it's not a Republican or a Democrat issue. There's not, if we go to Mike's station, there's not a Republican pump and then a Democrat pump. It's the same pump. But what we have found is that there are people on both sides of the aisle that are really trying to address this issue. So the question isn't, is it a Republican or Democrat, but which Republican and which Democrat?
Scott, registered Republican?
I am a registered Republican, but I will say that, I was a big skeptic when we started this project. I would have been one that would have rolled my eyes listening to all the patents and hidden technology. But I tell you what, I started this movie, I drove a giant truck. And now I drive a little teeny Honda Civic. And then after this Honda Civic, I plan on getting a diesel car so I can run on biodiesel.
Interesting you mentioned biodiesel. Let's go to Lydia in Golden Hill. Lydia, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, we bought a Mercedes diesel a while back so that we could run on biodiesel and straight vegetable oil. And we've been buying our oil at the Pearson fueling station. And I was wondering if there's a reason why biodiesel keeps up with the price of diesel, when it seems to me that the oil that you get is going to cost less than the oil that you're getting fossil fuels. Excuse me.
Well, cost less, maybe, maybe not. Mike?
It's a good question, and we get the question a lot at the station. And I can tell you, I'm one of the few industries that'll tell you what I make. And I make it 36 cents a gallon on the biodiesel last month. Now, that's less than 10%. That's with $100,000 worth of dedicated equipment to sell it. So we're making 36 cents a gallon, which is a little less than we've made in the past. We go out and shop biodiesel, and, you know, we don't make any. We shop it and try to get the very best price that we can. And so ultimately, we are subject to the biodiesel market, just like we are to the petroleum market. But what I have heard from the producers, a couple things, is their feedstock. You hear about the price of food going up. Biofuels is very intricate in that argument or discussions or concerns. And so the price of soy has been going up. That's a feedstock for biodiesel. The price of petroleum goes up. There is, and people will point out, there are still a lot of petroleum used in the production of biofuels. But the other thing is that, and I don't really fault them for this. If you make biodiesel for a living and you have millions of dollars invested in it, and the biodiesel producers are going out of business, they're not operating at full capacity by any stretch, and the price of diesel goes down a dime, you have to go down a dime. You are a slave to the market, for lack of a better term. And I can frankly see those bio producers saying, well, if I have to go down with the dime, I'm going to go up with the dime too. So there's some of that on that end, and people would like to tell me it shouldn't be that way. And okay. But it is a capitalistic system, and the people that have invested literally their millions of dollars in biodiesel are not going to stay alive unless they can make some money at it. And it's a source of frustration, because nobody's talking to them. They're talking to our clerks at the station, and there's a lot of frustration there.
There have been some questions raised about biodiesel and ethanol. Some people argue that if it comes from virgin crops, you're really not saving much, at least in terms of carbon emissions, when you use biodiesel or ethanol, because it takes about as much petroleum to develop the crops and bring them to market as you would if you were just buying gas for your car. Do you have an opinion on that, Mike?
I do. I think, first of all, you have to look at it at the macro level, and you have to compare it to oil. People often will say, I think ethanol is awful. And I say, compared to what? Well, compared to solar. Well, there are no solar cars. And there are no hydrogen cars either right now, so that you can buy. So you have to compare it to oil. And I agree, there is the right way to do biofuels, and there's the wrong way to do biofuels. And one of the worst ways to do ethanol is corn. And that's how we do it in this country. There are a lot of better ways to do it. Parallel Products in Rancho Cucamonga has been making ethanol from used, expired, out-of-date Coca-Cola and orange juice and things like that for years and years.
Cool.
And that goes into the market, and there's some of that being burned, but there's a lot more corn than that. A couple other things, they're making it out of used citrus peels in Florida. How many used citrus peels do you think there are in California? Things like that, wood biomass, and that's not happening a lot right now in this country. But if you put the profit motive into ethanol, then over time it'll do more to bring that cellulosic ethanol along than all the mandates and tax incentives or breaks in the world.
Well, where do you get your biodiesel? Are you able to get some biodiesel from recycled products, or is it from virgin crops?
Right now our biodiesel comes out of Imperial Western Products in the, up near Palm Springs, and that's the closest we can get it. But we are about 2 months away, I hope. I said this about a couple months ago, too. Right now, there's a company, New Leaf Biofuels, that is collecting used cooking oil in San Diego, and they are bringing it to their facility in South Bay, and they are very close to being able to produce it. So when that happens a couple months from now, we will transport the biofuels in a biodiesel vehicle, burning biodiesel. We will make it out of 100% waste product in the San Diego area, and the truck, here's the big thing, the petroleum delivery truck, typically, that will bring bring it from their facility in South Bay to us will also be using 100% biodiesel. And I'm going to have a press conference and call it Biofuels Critics Invited. Let's come and look and see how we do that. That's 2 months away.
Okay, well, I'll try to show up at that press conference. I'm Tom Fudge. You're listening to These Days. My guests are Mike Lewis, Jeremy Wagner, and Scott Roberts. Jeremy and Scott are co-directors, co-producers of a new documentary film called Gas Hole. Mike Lewis is general manager of Pearson Fuels and chairman of the San Diego Eco Center, which is going to be showing Gas Hole tomorrow and the next day. Let's take a couple of callers before we're out of time. Len is in Rancho Penasquitos. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for your time and efforts. I recently saw a newspaper article on San Diego Union editorial. It discussed or portrayed nuclear efforts, coal energy, and offshore drilling here in the United States. And I just wanted to throw that in the mix as far as your topic and see what you had to say about that as far as the limitations we have, the choices versus the conspiracy theory.
I'm sorry, Len, I don't quite get your point. What's your question?
I just wanted to know if this is a matter of choice for the U.S. People as far as why can't we drill offshore or drill in our own country or get a more economical way to harvest the coal or nuclear energy.
So, in other words, you're arguing in favor of just finding a better way to go after the fossil fuel that exists in this country?
Yes. Yeah, it's a matter of choice versus conspiracy, I think.
Okay. Thanks very much. Jeremy, you want to respond to that?
Absolutely. There's a couple of things that we learned when we were working on this film. One thing that I didn't realize, we thought we were relatively well-educated about the topic, but I didn't realize that the United States has been producing less oil every year since 1970. Before that, there was plenty of oil here. We found lots of great fields. We were drilling all over the place. There, you know, a few miles from my house in Los Angeles, there's pumps that are still pumping. The problem is that, and we examine this in our film, we've gotten most of the easy-to-find oil in the United States. And since the 1970s, every year we've been producing less and less. And that includes when we found oil in Alaska. We found these oil fields that we're pumping now. And when we found that oil, it didn't increase the amount that we were producing. It still just leveled off for a couple of years and then continued to decline. So the thing is even if we open up the ANWR and we're able to get that to the market immediately, which it's going to take years to get that petroleum to the market if you did that, and you could take all of that oil and put it to the market immediately, it would still only last for 6 months. Now, 6 months is not going to solve any of our problems.
So the choice we have to make, as far as you're concerned, is choosing alternative fuels.
Well, what we're really looking forward to, and this is something that Mike's doing, is producing energy locally. Now, I don't care what it is, what that energy is per se, but it has to be produced locally. And since there's not enough petroleum in the United States, and there are these better ways to do things, if you produce that energy locally, the $3 you spend stays here rather than two of those dollars going out of the country.
Any last word from you, Scott?
Well, we're excited to be here in San Diego. We're excited to be at the Eco Center. We think it's a fabulous place, and they're doing great things. And that's why we wanted to take the movie on tour, because we're going to be there after the screening to do Q&A sessions, and it's been fantastic to open up dialogue about the topic.
Jeremy Wagner and Scott Roberts are co-directors, co-producers of a new documentary film called Gas Hole, and you can see their film and hear a discussion with them tomorrow and Saturday, May 9th and 10th at the San Diego Eco Center on El Cajon Boulevard. Go to our website, kpbs.org, for more information on that. And Jeremy, Scott, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Oh, I just want to mention that if you're interested, we're going on a 43-city tour. You can check out our website, gasholemovie.com, and see where we've been and where we're going.
And Mike Lewis is general manager of Pearson Fuels and chairman of the San Diego Eco Center. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for having us. We hope you come by this weekend and see what we're doing.